the headlines. Millions of Americans are at risk of being forced out of their homes as a coronavirus-related ban on evictions is set to expire. China steps up efforts to curb its worst COVID-19 outbreak in months as fresh infections emerge in more parts of the country. And the U.S. seizes a Singapore-owned oil tanker for transferring petroleum products to North Korea. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Millions of Americans are at risk of being forced out of their homes as a nationwide ban on evictions expires on Saturday. This comes as the U.S. House of Representatives adjourned late Friday without extending a government moratorium on residential evictions that has been in place for 11 months. House Democrats tried to win bipartisan support to extend the ban, but their effort was blocked by Republicans. President Joe Biden had also asked Congress to extend the ban, but he had made it clear that his administration would not extend the moratorium without congressional approval. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered the eviction moratorium in September 2020. That is when over 20 million jobs were lost in the U.S. amid coronavirus pandemic shutdowns. They feared that increasing homelessness would boost COVID-19 infections. The U.S. has imposed new sanctions against Cuba, citing alleged human rights abuses.
Last week, we sanctioned the head of the Cuban Armed Forces and a government entity called the Black Berets for their involvement in suppressing protesters. And today we are adding sanctions against the Revolutionary National Police, as well as individual sanctions against the chief and deputy chief. And we're going to continue to add sanctions on individuals that carry out the regime's abuses. At the same time, we're increasing direct support to
U.S. President Joe Biden accused the Cuban government of mass detention of protesters and hosting sham trials. Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, slammed the sanctions. He said that they are part of U.S. arbitrary measures aimed at justifying its inhumane economic blockade against Cuba. Rodriguez had previously denounced the protests as, quote, systemic provocation by U.S.-backed dissidents. Cuba was the scene of protests over an ongoing economic crisis on July 11 and 12. Havana blames Washington's decades-long economic pressure as well as COVID-19 restrictions for the economic downturn. Commentator Bambos Shango says U.S. policies toward Cuba are one-sided and aimed at regime change in the Latin American country.
There seems to be some kind of discrepancy on how the U.S. view protests and what they think protests that is being mishandled is taking places in one place but not in another. And so instead of trying to raise the question of human rights in those places, they want to squeeze Venezuela, they want to squeeze Cuba, they want to squeeze Nicaragua, and so they attack those countries. It's very one-sided. It's tried to also create regime change in Cuba.
China has doubled down on efforts to curb its worst COVID-19 outbreak in months by extending mass testing and lockdowns as fresh infections emerge in more parts of the country. More than 1 million people have been placed under a lockdown to contain the Delta variant-fueled surge. Mass testing is also underway in various parts of the country, including in the southwestern megacity of Chongqing, home to over 30 million people. On Saturday, health officials confirmed 55 new cases, including in the southeastern province of Fujian. The recent outbreak first started in Jiangsu province. The cluster of infections has reached the capital Beijing and five provinces so far. Over 200 infections nationwide have been linked to the cluster. The strain poses a serious challenge to China's zero infection policy. Police in the Australian city of Sydney have asked citizens to avoid a planned anti-lockdown protest, warning that hundreds of security personnel have been deployed to prevent the rally.
I'd like to begin by sending one final message to anyone who is intending to go into the city to engage in protest activity. Do not do it. Our policing operation has been in place since early this morning. Up to 1,000 police officers, including a range of specialist resources, are on the ground already. So do not go into the city to protest.
Police have cordoned off downtown Sydney, setting up multiple checkpoints. The police have also banned taxi and rideshare services from taking passengers to demonstrations. On Friday, authorities imposed stricter lockdown, including a 5-kilometer travel limit, Sydney's worst-hit areas. Military forces were also deployed there to help police enforce the curbs. New measures were taken amid surging COVID cases, despite some restrictions already in place for over a month. Australians are angry over the restrictions. Thousands took to the streets last week to voice their anger. Iran has started vaccinating prisoners all across the country. The move is part of a vaccination program targeting priority groups. As Salman Khujuri reports, the country has set a record of vaccinating over 430,000 people in a single day.
On the occasion of the Eid al-Ghadir, Iran has officially begun vaccinating prisoners across the nation against the COVID-19 virus. Speaking at the vaccination ceremony, Iran's deputy health minister said that in view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days.
In view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days. Thanks to the proper observation of health protocols by prisoners, the average number of people infected with the virus in prisons has been less than ordinary people.
In the past couple of days, with the imports of foreign-made vaccines and the entry of domestically produced vaccines into the vaccination basket of the country, the pace of vaccination process has increased to the extent that, according to the Iranian health minister, the country has set a record of vaccinating over 430,000 people on a single day.
In the occasion of the auspicious Eid al-Ghadir, we have begun vaccinating all prisoners across the country. To vaccinate all prisoners and those working at prisons, we need over 200,000 doses of vaccines. This amount has already been supplied, and the vaccination process for prisoners will continue as planned. At today's ceremony at Evin Prison, in Tehran, 250 prisoners were among the first to receive the jabs.
Moreover, centers for drive-in vaccination across the country have been established, and they have played a major role in the increase in the daily vaccination rate. Iran is using a combination of locally produced vaccines and imported foreign-made vaccines in its national vaccination program. According to Iranian health officials, the country's homemade coronavirus vaccines develop immunity against the new mutations of the virus.
According to Iran's health ministry, almost 60 million Iranians will be vaccinated against the virus by the end of the current Iranian year in March 2022, using domestically produced and foreign-made vaccines. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
The U.S. has seized a Singapore-owned oil tanker for transferring petroleum products to North Korea. The U.S. Justice Department says that the ship, named MT Courageous, was confiscated by Cambodia last year. It accused the tanker's owner of making ship-to-ship transfers of oil to North Korean vessels. North Korea is the subject of United Nations and other sanctions over its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. The sanctions restrict its imports of oil and other items. Independent journalist and analyst Fabrizio Goldoni believes that the U.S. confiscation of the oil tanker is an act of piracy because U.S. sanctions on North Korea are unilateral.
The point is this. On the U.N. Security Council passed against North Korea several resolutions, okay? In 2000, 2003, 2006, 13, 16. The point is this one. The United Security Council passed a specific resolution against the nuclear proliferation, while the U.S. sanctions are much, much, much larger. You know, they go and they want to cripple, basically, the North Korea economy, and in this way, the human cost on the population is huge. So I say that these sanctions basically are illegal and are illegitimate. I can say that maybe they're like the pirates, you know, in this case. They assault vessel in international water or in Cambodia water, it doesn't matter, you know. Basically, behind this one, there is no real legal background. This is the point.
Sources say the attack on an Israeli-owned ship off Oman was carried out in retaliation for a recent raid by the Tel Aviv regime in Syria. Resistance sources told Iran's Al Alam news network that the attack on the ship was in response to the Israeli strike on an airport in Syria's western Qusair region. The Israeli attack had killed two resistance forces. According to the British military, the Israeli vessel was targeted near Masira Island late on Thursday. It said the attack that left two crew members dead was not an act of piracy, adding an investigation is underway. The U.S.'s military says that a drone was used to target the vessel. The U.S. and Israel have blamed the attack on Tehran, which has made no official comment on the accusation yet. Political analyst Mohsen Saleh says the resistance front will not allow the Israeli regime to commit crimes with impunity.
Resistance access won't permit Israelis to commit any crimes without retaliation, whether from the Yemen or Lebanon or Syria or Palestine or Tehran or any place of the resistance axis. So I guess they have to expect that the resistance forces can reach them anywhere. So they are playing a losing game with the resistance axis, whether when they attack at Syrian borders or the Iraq-Syrian borders or at Tehran when they commit assassinations or do any aggressions against this power. Now the balance of power is for the sake or for the interest of the access of resistance. So they have to recalculate their existence or their hostilities against these teams, these groups, whether in Lebanon or in Syria or in Iraq even. So all these teams, they are really willingly are ready to re-attack or retaliate on the aggressions of the Israelis and won't benefit them or won't do any use for them, these naturalizations with some of the Arab countries or with the backers of the Americans and the Westerns.
At least 13 people have been killed and dozens more injured in an attack by Daesh terrorists in the northern Iraqi province of Salawaddin. Provincial police source said that the incident took place after the armed terrorists opened fire on people taking part in a funeral in a village north of Baghdad late on Friday. The source also said that the terrorists then attacked a nearby checkpoint. Three policemen were among the victims. A medical source said some of the wounded people are in critical condition. Iraq's military said in a statement that it will provide details once an investigation is complete. Northern Iraq has been the scene of sporadic Daesh attacks since the defeat of the terrorist group in late 2017. Russia says that it is opposed to the addition of any new points to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
Indeed, the agreed goal of the Vienna talks is to restore the original JCPOA. Nothing more and nothing less. All participants should take care of not creating, even non-intentionally, impression that they deviate from this common goal and try to add something new to the deal.
The comments come as the talks for the revival of the international accord in the Austrian capital appear to have been deadlocked. Tehran says Washington has demanded talks on irrelevant topics like Iran's missile defense program. That is while the Islamic Republic has time and again expressed opposition to any renegotiation of the deal. Iran has reduced its commitments under the nuclear agreement, citing the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their share of their obligations. University lecturer Vladimir Goldstein says that the Biden administration is in no rush to revive the Iran nuclear deal as it is, especially with Republicans in Israel ready to leap at the issue to score points against Democrats.
But it's absolutely clear that it's not in the interest of the United States. There is no burning issue. It was a burning issue for Democrats to blame Trump for walking out of the deal. So they were very happy with that. But now, having got rid of Trump, I don't think they're particularly interested in getting this deal. Because, you know, it's absolutely clear that the United States doesn't have much to gain. Social benefits for the United States are not that good, but they might have something to lose. You know, Democrats might be accused of accommodating Iran. Don't forget that within the United States, Iran is a very comfortable figure. They blame everything on Iran. So, and that's what they continue to blame everything. And they will continue to say that Iran creates problems. So, and that's kind of works for Democrats, because otherwise, if they make a deal, they'll be accused by Republicans of giving up or not insisting, of missing something what Iran does, and so on. So the opponents of the deal are still continue to be strong, and they continue to push to be against it. And I don't see any kind of forces which will indeed like a previous speaker said, which would make Americans sit down and negotiate. One force can be is Europeans, but Europeans, we know, sort of usually take the lead from America, because Europeans really stand to gain something from this deal, but they don't have enough strength to convince Americans to sit down. And we just heard from Blinken, who said the negotiation would go on forever, and we're ready to walk out, and so on. And I think that's the attitude of the U.S. establishment.
UN agencies have warned that hunger is expected to rise in 23 global hotspots in the next 3 months. The Food and Agriculture Organization and World Food Program say the food insecurity is likely to further deteriorate across the world. They say that people in parts of Ethiopia, Madagascar, Yemen, South Sudan, and Nigeria could experience catastrophic situations as a result of war and famine. The specialist sounded the alarm for Ethiopia, where death from acute hunger is projected to rise to over 400,000. UN bodies have called for urgent international aid to prevent humanitarian catastrophe in these countries. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight. The window to avoid climate catastrophe is closing with every passing day. Britons are in the decisive decade in this fight, and they must treat the climate crisis as an issue that stands alone in the combination of its urgency and the shadow it casts over future generations. We now present you an article written by Ed Miliband. the Labour MP for Doncaster North and Shadow Business, Energy and Industry Secretary. The piece is titled Britain's Biggest Enemy is No Longer Climate Denial, but Climate Delay. Future generations will look back on the climate events of 2021 and say that was the year Britons ran out of excuses. Heat waves and flooding in the United Kingdom, temperatures topping 50 degrees Celsius in Pakistan, hundreds killed by a heat wave in British Columbia in Western Canada, deadly floods in Germany and China, all within a single month. Add to that, the recent dire warning from the Met Office that the age of extreme weather has just begun. The wake-up call that this offers is not just the obvious one, that climate breakdown is already in the United Kingdom. It also illustrates that British people in this generation are in a unique position in the history of this crisis. Climate breakdown can no longer be plausibly denied as a threat etched only in the future. And all too soon, avoiding it may be a luxury lost to the past. The window to avoid catastrophe is closing with every passing day. Britons are in the decisive decade in this fight, and they must treat the climate crisis as an issue that stands alone in the combination of its urgency and the shadow that it casts over all future generations. The actions we take defy the normal rhythm of political cycles. What we do in the next few years will have effects for hundreds of years to come. Unless the world cuts emissions in half in this decade, we will probably lose the chance to avoid warming of significantly more than 1.5 degrees Celsius set out in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. We have seen the catastrophic effects of a world warmed by just 1.2 degrees Celsius. What happens if we get to 2.5 degrees Celsius or even 3 degrees Celsius? By then, we look back at recent summers as not the hottest we've ever had, but in all likelihood, the coolest we will ever have again. The accompanying truth is that our biggest enemy is no longer climate denial, but climate delay. The most dangerous opponents of change are no longer the shrinking minority who deny the need for action, but the supposed supporters of change who refuse to act at the pace the science demands. As Bill McKibben, environmentalist and climate scholar, says on climate, winning slowly is the same as losing. Ed Miliband, a Labour MP for Doncaster North, says, "The UK government is a case in point. There is a chasm between the boosterish rhetoric of Boris Johnson government and reality. We are way off meeting our climate targets, which are themselves insufficiently ambitious, graded somewhere below 4 out of 10 for delivery by the Climate Change Committee. Nothing is more dangerous than the mirage of action shrouding the truth of inaction, because it breeds either false confidence that we will be okay or cynicism and despair about meaningless political promises. But why are they failing? Above all, because of a dogged refusal to put government investment at a scale behind a green recovery. The more government refuses to provide the proper plan and finance, the harder decisions on boilers, cars and industrial transition become. A government that absents its responsibility for making these transitions is a government that will fail to make them happen. This is not simply failing to protect Britons from the biggest long-term threat they face. It's economically illiterate too. The case for investing now is not just clear as a question of intergenerational equity, it's also the only conclusion to draw from a hard-headed fiscal analysis of the costs and benefits. the Office for Budget Responsibility tells the British people that the costs of acting early are surprisingly small relative to their national income. In the central scenario, an average annual investment in net terms of just 0.4% of gross domestic product GDP between now and 2050. Meanwhile, we know that inaction is entirely unaffordable, leaving massive costs of climate damage racked up and left for future generations. The Office for Budget Responsibility also tells us that delay will significantly raise the cost of action, in part because we're baking high carbon into our infrastructure. We will have to make the transition at some point. Failing to act now will betray our children and our grandchildren, and will just end up costing more. We should act now, not just because we must avoid future generations living in a disaster movie, but because rewriting the script can produce a better world. Rapid decarbonisation is the imperative, but we can do so in a way that fixes the inequalities that exist in our current economic system. This is the promise of the Green New Deal, that is, transformative programme of investment can also generate good jobs, help existing industries transition and create new ones, ensure warmer homes, cleaner air, and a lasting shift in wealth and power across our country. This is the vision that we must fight for. Particularly in this year of all years, what we do here at home has a real impact around the world. If other governments believe that a country that has purportedly led the way on climate is full of hot air, it simply undermines trust and lets the big polluters off the hook. In the less than 100 days left to COP26 summit in Glasgow, the Prime Minister must finally wake up to the fact that this is not a glorified international photo opportunity, but a complex and fragile negotiation where he must deliver at home and engage in the hard yards of diplomacy. Just over 50 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. said of the fight for racial and economic justice, "We're now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In the unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. As the generation that stands astride the causes and consequences of this climate emergency, we must take heed of those words."
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, says what's happened since the 2015 nuclear deal was signed vindicates the fact that the West is not a trustworthy interlocutor. Not much has changed for a complying Iran. The Trump-era maximum pressure policies are still there under the Biden administration that's not even willing to guarantee it won't violate the deal like its predecessor. Washington says the ball is Iran's court. Tehran blames the U.S. and its excessive demands. Both sides say the negotiations cannot go on forever. In the spotlight tonight will be the fate of the Iran nuclear deal. Stay with us. Let's watch a report first.
The arduous road of reviving the Iran nuclear agreement seems to have come to an impasse. So far, the U.S. has claimed on multiple occasions that it is willing and ready to return to the nuclear accord, but its actions show otherwise. On Thursday, Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations outlined some of the U.S. and its allies' demands. Kazem Gharibabadi said the U.S. has demanded talks on Iran's regional influence and its missile programs in return for removing sanctions and fully implementing the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. He also noted that the U.S. refuses to comply with Security Council Resolution 2231 that removed the ban on the transfer of arms to or from Iran on October 18, 2020. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sought to extend the ban, but the U.N. Security Council rejected Washington's push. Gharibabadi said the United States has also failed, among other things, to give assurances that it will not repeat its previous behaviors regarding the deal. A day earlier, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, slammed Washington for its stubborn demands in talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal, and said the United States had failed to guarantee that it would never abandon the pact again. He said the U.S. once violated the nuclear deal at no cost by exiting it. Now they explicitly say they cannot give guarantees that it would not happen again. Tehran says its mistrust in Washington was vindicated in May 2018, when former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the deal and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Now, 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal, U.S. officials claim they're willing to remove sanctions on Iran. But in practice, they're refusing to do so, fueling Iran's mistrust of the U.S.
The ball remains in Iran's court, and we will see if they are prepared to make the decisions necessary to come back into compliance. We are committed to diplomacy, but this process cannot go on indefinitely.
This as Blinken has in the past described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy. Given Washington's refusal to rejoin the JCPOA, Iran started to gradually reduce its commitments under the deal, citing the remaining signatories' failure to uphold their obligations and neutralize the impact of the U.S.'s unilateral measures. Now, while the resumption of talks in Vienna has been postponed until the new administration in Iran takes charge next month, the fate of the JCPOA still seems to be hanging on American politicians, who have so far shown no sign of readiness in altering their anti-Iran policies.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najaf, and I'm going to discuss the Iran nuclear deal tonight with these gentlemen. Journalist and political commentator Mostafa Khoshesh in Tehran. And West Coast coordinator of the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker in San Francisco. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's start with Tehran. Mostafa, the U.S. quit the 2015 nuclear deal under Donald Trump, and that was despite the fact that both Washington and the IAEA confirmed Tehran's compliance. Now, how can Iran trust the Biden administration and go on with negotiations for which Washington is not even offering any sort of guarantee?
Hello, Behrouz, and thanks for having me. Well, actually, there is no way to trust the United States. The JCPOA itself displayed to Iranians that they could never, ever trust the United States. It was not the first time, actually. In the past two decades, Iran and the U.S. or its European allies, they have had six agreements, with the JCPOA being the last one. In all these agreements, according to American officials and European officials, as well as in some of them, according to IAEA reports, Iran has been in compliance with its undertakings. And because it has always thought that the U.S. and its European allies are looking for a conflict resolution, while the U.S. and its allies have never complied with the terms of the agreements, because they've just been looking for containing Iran's power, and they have not been looking for conflict resolving the conflict. As a matter of fact, Tehran has only one option. You know, in international relations, when there are treaties, especially if one of the parties is a member of the UNSC, the UN Security Council, then you have to be very watchful, you have to be on guard, and you have to keep the pressure, and I mean, of your power in your hands, because there is no other way to guarantee yourself. Even the congressional approval doesn't work in here. The United States withdrew from over a dozen agreements under Donald Trump. Some of them had congressional approvals, from Iran nuclear agreement to INF treaty to Paris Climate Accord, NAFTA, Transatlantic. It withdrew its membership from UNESCO, and it threatened to discard its membership in WHO. So some of them had the UN backing, the UN Security Council backing, and congressional approval and endorsement, but still the U.S. didn't care because the United States feels that it's exceptional in terms of President Obama, or America first, as Donald Trump said. So they feel might is right. So in that aspect, Tehran has no other way but to make sure that the opposite side is complying with its agreement. That's why Iran has stated and insisted that the U.S. should first remove all the sanctions in compliance with JCPOA, and Tehran should verify it and see if it happened. It's happening in action. Then Tehran would comply with its undertakings, because these undertakings are Tehran's leverages on the United States.
Okay, now to San Francisco. Richard, one of the sticking points is the U.S. refusal to provide guarantee. It won't leave the pact again. Washington violated the nuclear deal, and at no cost, of course, and exited it. So why do you think Washington is not committing itself to a deal by actually offering some tangible sort of assurance or guarantee?
Well, I agree with the other guests that even if there are the congressional guarantees, they are not really guarantees. They are seen in Washington as temporary in character, as are all the treaties and agreements that the United States government has entered into with either countries or peoples or agencies that it views as being in opposition to U.S. policies in any way. I mean, if we can go back through the history of treaties in the United States, the hundreds and hundreds of treaties with Native peoples on in the continent, which were all regarded as temporary treaties. The withdrawal from international organizations that your other guest mentioned, which are also viewed as being in opposition to U.S. interests or the interests of that particular administration. The real objective of the Biden administration and its foreign policy team, which is really a neocon formation, is to weaken Iran. That's their view, their objective, their goal is to weaken Iran's presence in the region and to find ways in which to do that. So now you have the Blinken-led effort trying to impose new conditions or get Iran to accept new conditions in order to have the JCPOA revived, perhaps only on a temporary basis. And one of the problems here, of course, one of the big problems, and this is a problem with the JCPOA when it was signed, was the uncertainty of what is called the international community over whether or not the agreement was going to hold. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of that were to prevent many companies and financial institutions and countries, governments, from doing much in the way of relaxing the sanctions. There was some relaxation, for sure, but many of them held back from engaging in what is considered, if you can consider it that way, normal trade and normal commercial and trade relations with Iran because of an anticipation, or at least the possibility that the agreements could be canceled by the U.S. government on a unilateral basis at any time.
Now, Mustafa, Blinken is saying that his country is waiting to see what Iran is ready to do or not to do and make a decision. Iran has done what it's supposed to do, hasn't it? So it's the U.S. that abandoned the deal. So how can Blinken say that the ball remains in Iran's court?
Well, you're right. Iran has done its part. there's no doubt about that. Iran stayed under the nuclear deal for 14 months after Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear accord in May 2018, in the hope that the Europeans would at least comply with their undertakings and would make up for their loss. But they never took any action, and then Iran started modifying its undertakings. And it took a year for Iran to go after these modifications, but still, it stayed under the nuclear deal. Iran is still under the nuclear deal. It's a party to the deal, but the U.S. has exited the deal, and therefore, it's the U.S. that should make up for, the wrong actions that it's done. And this has been acknowledged even by other parties to the deal, not just the Russians or the Chinese, the Europeans. Until a few months ago, they acknowledged that the U.S. should take the first action because they left the deal and they are still outside and they've caused much damage to the Iranian economy. But let me tell you, Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, is completely wrong and right. He's wrong for the fact that I just said it, but he's right because it seems that the U.S. is very much adamant to do the right thing. So they need a new impetus, a motivation. This could be done by Iran in a couple of ways. It could reduce pressures on the U.S. and give in to the U.S. demands and say, okay, let's go ahead with whatever you give us and you said in the last round of talks in Vienna. Well, Iran has already done this option when it started the JCPOA talks and it signed the deal. It agreed to give some concessions in return for the U.S. concessions, and we know what happened, that the U.S. defied the deal altogether, and it never complied with it. The same is true about the Europeans, and it could also go the other way. It could motivate the U.S. through increasing pressures, and it's already done that once, and it has received a very positive response. Let's remember that when Biden took office, he said Iran's nuclear deal is not a priority. If Iran wants us to prioritize revival of the nuclear deal, they need to reverse their actions and the modifications that they've done and go for a full resumption of their undertakings under the nuclear deal. So Iran never did that. They motivated Biden, but not the way that he desired. They increased the pressure through a parliamentary approval that laid more pressure on the White House through four leverages. And then Biden changed the approach. And in a matter of 3 weeks, he sent a delegation to the Vienna talks. So Iran increased the pressure, and it worked. The same is true this time, I believe, especially with a Raisi administration in office. And especially after all these experiences that Iran has had through, under the nuclear deal with the United States, I believe Iran is preparing to increase pressures on the United States in order to motivate Mr. Blinken and his boss.
Okay. Now, Richard, Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, had warned already on several occasions that the West wouldn't commit itself to implementing its undertakings under deal. I didn't even would ask for more. He had warned it. You just give him an inch, I'll take a mile. And that's exactly what happened. Instead of Washington trying to return to the deal it left, it's asking for discussing some other stories not related to the nuclear issue, like Iran's missile program and regional activity. Let's have your take on that.
Well, the Trump administration was much grosser. Its foreign policy was self-evidently imperialistic and degrading to other countries. The Biden administration's foreign policy team isn't that way. They're more diplomatic, but it reminds us that of an old saying that diplomacy is perjury. And I think in this case, we can see that it is. What the U.S. officials, the top officials in the foreign policy establishment in the United States, are pursuing what is essentially the same objective as the Trump administration and many before it, since the time of the Iranian Revolution, that is to bring about regime change, and if they can't achieve regime change, to weaken Iran's influence in a key strategic area of the world. That's what the objective mm-hmm. really is. So they're going forward in this way because that objective has not changed. And it will be interesting to see, as Mustafa mentioned, whether or not the increased pressure from Iran will push the Biden administration into an agreement. I should also mention that the Biden administration has continued its extremely hostile, position toward Venezuela and toward Cuba. And despite having said in the run-up to the election that it would go back to the Obama administration's position on Cuba, that has not happened. And in fact, the sanctions against Cuba have been increased by the Biden administration. And that should be a sign of how they stand in regard to other countries they regard as adversaries, meaning Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, et cetera, China.
And Mustafa, the United States insists to kind of tie and link Iran's missile program and regional policies to the nuclear deal. Now, Iran says that these issues are not on the table, they are not negotiable. Why should anyone, nobody would negotiate their deterrence power, would they?
No, of course not. But let's remember that up until 2005, the United States tried every option, and it considered many scenarios and possibilities to do a regime change in Iran. But after a series of developments in 2006 and the rise of Iran's power in the region, they started developing schemes in order to contain Iran. They realized that they may not do a regime change, and they need to go for introductory steps before they could do that. They needed to contain Iran's power. And when Obama was elected to office, and even a couple of months before that, they had a manual, they had a strategy that was called containment strategy, working through a characteristic policy. On one side, they try to, build Iran's confidence that they are willing for a conflict resolution this time. On the stick side, they use military threats, credible military threats, but of course not action. If action was possible, they would have already done that. But they posed military threats alongside sanctions, a new regime of sanctions that was completely different to the sanctions before or imposed on any other nation, including Iran. And then they hoped that they increased the cost so that they could push Iran to talks. Then, in the first step, they hoped that they could slow down Iran's progress in each of these three areas of Iran's nuclear industries, Iran's missile power, Iran's regional clout, though it would not stop there. Once they embrace success as a result of this formula, they would go on and on and on, and they would ask for Iran's drone industries, they would ask for Iran's laser industry, and right. So on and so forth. When we said that, they were just looking for Iran's ballistic missile containment, but now they are also asking for containing Iran's cruise missile industries in their recent remarks.
We're running out of time.
Let me wrap it up. Yeah, okay. Let me wrap it up just one sentence. So what they intend to do is good if they go all this way along through multiple agreements, slowing down Iran's progress, stopping it, and then rolling back Iran's power components in all these mm-hmm. areas. So one agreement is not good, but they need to have to revive this nuclear deal and continue it in other areas in order to contain Iran's overall power. Okay. That's the ultimate purpose.
Okay,
Iran has realized that they would never allow them to
Okay, Richard, we only have 30 seconds. Iran seriously doubts and mistrusts the U.S. intentions. Does it have good reasons for that?
Well, it does. And I would just point out the containment in the verbiage of U.S. foreign policy has always actually been a polite term for overthrow.
Okay. All right. With that, we come to the end of this Spotlight show. Let me thank our guests. We had journalist and political commentator Mustafa Khushchashmin, Tehran, and West Coast Coordinator of the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, who joined us in San Francisco. And that's it for this edition of The Spotlight. I've been your host, Behrouz Najaf.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Greetings, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to Light Upon Light. We would like to congratulate all the Shias around the world for today, or these days are the days of remembering the birthday of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam. With me today is my beloved brother, Sheikh Muhammad. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for coming, Sheikh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so very much for having me. Well, fortunately this time, we are going to talk about the life of Imam Kazim Salatullah Alayhi, the seventh Imam of Shia. You know, the history tells us, when studying the history, the time of Imam Kazim Alayhi Salam was a time of oppression. As the time of other Ahlul Bayt, but, you know, going on all the way to Imam, to Sahib al-Zaman Salatullah Alayhi, it became harder, and the oppression became more strict, more confined. So, you know, the rulers of Abbasi, they were oppressively ruling the country, right? And going forward, they found more about the virtues of Ahlul Bayt, about the power of Ahlul Bayt, because they had experience from the Bani Umayyah. They
the love of the people towards Ahlul Bayt.
Yes, the love of
the respect
people
towards
and
them.
The obedience, respect of people towards Ahlul Bayt. And they feared so much more. So what they did was to confine and to put Imam alayhi salam into more limitations. Even physically, they located imams into, for example, Imam Kazim salawatullah alayhi, they imprisoned Imam Kazim salawatullah
alayhi. Most of his life he was imprisoned.
Most of his life. So they tried to control Imam alayhi salam this way. Now, what Imam Kazim salawatullah alayhi did in his life is very astonishing. You know, through these limitations, if you are able to build a network and do what you want to manage the affairs that you have. That's a very powerful kind of presence. That's a good command that you have. And Imam Kazim salallahu alayhi is, you know, this way. I think previously we talked about the agency of Ahlul Bayt, like an office, an organization that started with Imam Kazim salallahu alayhi. So Imam Kazim alayhi salam started this agency and sent out to different points of the
A way to earth, connect with the Shias.
Yes. To do what is necessary to be done to connect to the Shia, to guide them, to answer their questions, also to receive their monetary affairs, for example, homes and zakat, anything that was needed to be received.
The answering of questions and not only fiqh or law questions, but beliefs as well, theology.
Yes,
as well.
Most importantly, theology questions. So the first thing is to build this construction, this organization. And through this organization, so many things was done. The first thing was answering the questions and teaching, most importantly, teaching the Shia about what God wants them to do and what Ahlul Bayt before them have taught. For example, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, teaching about the accounts of Ahlul Bayt, about these narrations. The second thing was these monetary affairs, homes, zakat. The third thing was to be in connection, you know, because there is a very intimate relationship between Imam and the Shia. You need to talk to your Imam, you need to ask him sometimes. You need to, you know, be in touch.
Connection with him.
Yes, and that connection is very important. The other step that Imam Kazim alayhi salam took was to appoint some special companions and students of his to the government of Harun, which was the oppressive ruler of that time.
Oh, like an inside man.
Yes. For example, one of those person is those people is called Ali ibn Yaqti, which is a very famous companion of Imam Kazim salallahu alayhi wa sallam, a very smart student. Ali ibn Yaqti, you know, studying the knowledge of Rajal, which is about these significant people in the history of Ahlul Bayt.
Whether they were acceptable to take narrations from or not, in that manner, right?
About them, what kind of people they were, what they did, how, what are their beliefs and faiths, and are they trustable to receive narrations from or not. Ali ibn Yaqni is among the best. He's one of those that Imam Qazim alayhi salam and also Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, other Ahlul, they have talked about him themselves. They have praised him so much. He has been very smart, very smart. He has had a knack for verbal fighting with the enemies of Ahlul Bayt and winning, you know, making them lose, defending Ahlul Bayt in terms of theology. So Imam Kazim alayhi salam pointed him to go into the government of Harun and act as a spy, like an inside man, as you said. And this had several benefits. Although Ali ibn Yaqtin so many times told Imam Kazim that if it's possible, I do not want to be in his government. I do not want to. It's difficult for me to help him because he is oppressive and he is evil. But Imam alayhi salam told him that this responsibility is something that God wants from you. If you are there, you can help your brothers, the Shia, so much. You can help me.
So there's a benefit of him being inside the government.
Yes, there are so much benefits for you, and you are an exception. You can be there. But otherwise, generally, you cannot be in the governments of oppressive rulers.
Sheikh, unfortunately, we have to take a short break. Brothers and sisters, please stay tuned on Light Upon Light. We would like to congratulate you on the birthday of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. We'll be back in a short break.
Imam Kazim, the seventh Shia leader, was born in the month of Dhul-Hijjah, 128 after Hijra in Holy Medina. Imam Kazim was contemporary to the Abbasid Caliphate, who held strong enmities towards the Shia Muslims and the followers of the Prophet's household. The Abbasid rulers were behind many holocausts where large numbers of people who were all descendants of the Islamic Prophet were condemned to death. The suppressive policies of the Abbasid rulers scattered the Shia community and forced them to leave their homes and relocate in distant areas from the capital. In the light of this unfortunate event, one of the major achievements of Imam Kazem was the creation of a functional and wide network of